We're going to depart from the usual procedure, as Mr. Rishon has to leave shortly after his paper. So we would like to make a 15-minute session immediately after he has delivered the paper for questions. Then we'll close it abruptly and let him go, and then we'll go on with Mr. Sherman. And now, Mr. Rishon.
The title of my paper is Abraham Kahn, a mentor and guide of the Jewish labor movement in America. Abraham Kahn, born in the year 1860, died in the year 1951, has come to be regarded as a representative man of the great Jewish migration from Eastern Europe. And his place in the American Jewish epoch is not likely to be contested. But it is vital that it be understood. For he alone, of all his contemporaries, virtually framed in his long life, longer than that of any president of the United States, the total American Yiddish saga in all its fullness and tension. And central to that saga was the Jewish labor movement, myth, symbol, vision, and reality of Jewish and world reconstruction, of which he was guide, mentor, scribe, and patriarch. Kahn was the embattled pioneer of the most precipitous revolution to occur in nearly 2,000 years of Jewish history. He was to be the Moses, the Columbus, the Washington, and the Neil Lincoln, all wrapped in one. Indeed, the household god of a pariah people, classic to the consciousness of the West, and badly in need of an interpreter in the late 19th and early 20th century when they entered upon the American scene. Scores of others, and talented others, aspired to roles similar to Kahn's, but lacked the tenacity, the single-mindedness, the resilience, the insight, and above all, the talent for mass psychology that was his. No one was more superbly endowed for the sole strategic place of leadership open to a man of his gifts and background in a democratic society than was Kahn. He alone of the Jewish pioneers sustained a tensely active, lifelong relationship with the three decisively 20th century world civilizations, the American, the Russian, and the Yiddish, all in process of self-discovery, all keyed to messianic visions and expectations, and all central to the modern Jewish experience. In a world of cataclysmic change, where hope always mingled with despair, he and his monument, the Jewish Daily Forward, proved the only enduring of focus and beacon. As editor of a unique national newspaper, with an audience in its flush years approaching 500,000 readers, ranging across 12 metropolitan editions from Boston to Los Angeles, Kahn acquitted a role of leadership at the center of gravity of a great folk upheaval in the last great era of American journalism, for which he had schooled himself with the passion of a self-made man from the outset of his career. "I came to America," he confided many years later, "because I wanted to shape the Jewish community." And shape it he did. As editor, teacher, novelist, lecturer, pamphleteer, educator, literary and dramatic critic, cultural ambassador and arbiter, international troubleshooter, and Lower East Side spokesman and labor leader, Kahn was ever in the public eye, searching for the drama, at times darting out from the wings into the center of the stage, dramatizing the transformation of an antique people into an avant-garde people. Kahn's genius, and I think I am right in calling it that, his ability to mirror, cajole, capture, and lead a large segment of the immigrant Jewish community based within the matrix of the Jewish labor movement demands an explanation. What were the sources of his originality, adaptability, and staying power? What were the mainsprings of his achievement? What made him unique? The Kahn story, in some form and some outline, a vague outline, is remarkably familiar. For nearly three generations, legend and myth have fashioned a whipping boy, ancient and formidable, to account for all the failures and incongruities, all the confusion, instability, inanity, and perhaps even immorality of the area of an era when pseudo-messiahs and other keepers of the Jewish soul were as numerous as today they are few. The high visibility of the Yiddish press lord of East Broadway, he was 10 stories high, and I'm not sure of the full story of the building of the Jewish Daily Forward, but it didn't have to be 10 stories high, made him a skyscraper editor. And his seeming immortality assured Kahn's assailants that they were always on target. Yet the real, as well as the legendary Kahn, can be studied with greater precision and edification than can the lives of a dozen of his contemporaries. Kahn himself saw to that, for he had an uncanny sense of history, not in the academic sense, of course, in addition to a remarkable integrity. The open record of his newspaper, the Jewish Daily Forward and its predecessors, the vitality of the great Jewish migration itself that found him grist for the mill of Yiddish newspaper row, as well as a grand human interest feature for the general press, his pamphlets, popular works of biography, history and travel, novels, short stories, literary criticism, and the torrent of words in Russian, Yiddish, and English that poured from his pen over 70 years, his magnificent five-volume memoir that might have been eight, the vast international correspondence that passed across his desk in half a dozen languages, and the recollections of his many associates at perhaps 100 different angles provide a marvelous storehouse for the historian and biographer without parallel in the history, I'm certain, of American journalism, and perhaps that means of journalism in the world. It is a complex story in a complex age that's eminently worthy of our fullest attention. Its outlines, however, are simple. And this afternoon's paper will be confined largely to schematic analysis and outline. For Abraham Kahn was an uncommon, common man, an extraordinary, ordinary man. Chronologically, Kahn's career may be sectioned into three overlapping phases: the years of the agitator, the years of the statesman, and the years of the patriarch. Transversely, his career may be sectioned into four intersecting spheres: the Russian, the Jewish, the American, and the international. And of course, sourcing his career in its every phase and its every sphere was an effervescent youthfulness, which he and his associates alike considered his supreme virtue. as Morris Hillquit was to record in his memoir of some 30-odd years ago. His life, that is Kahn's life, was an uninterrupted succession of enthusiasms. Whatever interest happened to take hold of him at the moment dominated his thoughts and actions to the exclusion of everything else. Here we can only suggest, by way of illustration, some of the major turning points in the many lives of Abraham Kahn. The first, for at least the purposes of this afternoon's paper, was to come early in the year 1882, when young Kahn, at loose ends, received the following message from his mother. "My dear son, your friend whom you introduced to R is dead. He departed on Monday, and yesterday they buried him deep, deep, deep. Dear son, winter is coming. The holidays are approaching. I know you are rather lax in your religious beliefs. It's time for you to mend. Here in Vilna, your old friends are abandoning their wild ways. You must do the same. Let me also warn you not to expose yourself to the cold. Buy a shawl for your neck, and don't risk your life. Your mother." To this audience of conspirators, I think it is quite apparent that this note from Kahn's mother is not meant to be taken literally, and certainly Kahn did not. He always had a great... Yes, I don't... is this working?
It's turning on
there. Oh, I see. The cryptic note was easily deciphered by Kahn. The mention of the dead comrade, the admonition to be a good Jew, the warning to beware of winter's frost, meant that the headquarters of the revolutionary cell to which young Kahn belonged had been raided, that the leaders had been arrested, and that he was under police surveillance. 3 days later, Abraham Kahn was apprehended, and rather than await Russian justice, he chose to flee to America. Russia, its language, its literature, and its revolutionary tradition would give lifelong resonance and a certain hauteur to Abraham Kahn. Indeed, his first efforts as a journalist, a series of reports for Ruski of Rye that appeared between January 1881 and January 1883, describing conditions in Europe and later in America, and an acute analysis of the presidential campaign of 1884 that appeared in Vestnik Europa proved to be his first efforts at journalism, but these were to be his last in Russian. American conditions were already carrying Kahn off in different directions in search of another popular will. The journey to America in 1882 of the Russian revolutionary traversed a path that his future readers were to approximate in the next half century. Velizh, Mohilev, Rogachev, Kiev, Berdichev, the Austrian border, Broad, Lemberg, Krakow, Breslau, Berlin, Hamburg, Liverpool, Philadelphia, and New York. And in the process, Kahn was already carving out a new life and another identity. At Broad, Kahn was momentarily intoxicated by the ideals of the Am Olam, the Eternal People Movement, but on his arrival on New York's Lower East Side, he regained his poise quickly, realized, unlike his associates, that communitarian agricultural colonies in America, no less than in Palestine, were utopian and doomed to fail. For Kahn, the vast metropolis and the reality of proletarianization for the millions to come proved the unavoidable challenge. A tour of factory employment separating Coronas from leaves in a cigar shop and a brief spell in a sheet metal stamping plant buttressed Kahn's aversion for manual labor that had been implanted by a boyhood apprenticeship to a carver, but subjected him to the realities of industrial life that would be central to his subsequent role as labor leader and agitator. On July 26, 1882, Kahn's career suddenly acquired an American meaning. On that day, to the dismay of his Russian-speaking associates, he made the first socialist public address in Yiddish in the United States, guaranteeing himself a capacity audience, which the speaker apparently has not had the foresight to do, by having handbills in Yiddish printed as his own expense and personally distributing them, aided by his ever-loyal, lifelong friend, Bernard Weinstein, a founder and chronicler of the United Hebrew Trades. His talk, in which Kahn defined the basic principles of Marxism, like his second socialist talk 2 weeks later on August 3rd, when, as he sheepishly notes in his memoirs, he did little more than harangue his audience, urging them to march up Fifth Avenue and to seize the mansions of the millionaires, were not significant, clearly, for their content. What was significant, of course, was the discovery by Abraham Kahn of a new language. For Kahn, the discovery of Yiddish as a viable means of communication was to be the basis for a totally new kind of career, unimaginable in Russia, and only gradually understood by Kahn's associates in New York. Kahn's discovery of Yiddish was for him a persistent source of pride. As early as 1901, when he was a police reporter with a New York Commercial Advertiser on sabbatical from the Jewish Daily Forward, he portrayed himself for posterity in the Cyclopedia of American Biography as the first in this country to deliver a labor speech in their dialect. Indeed, a French handbill that was circulated in Paris some years later broadcast his claim to international fame. On Monday, June 3rd, 1912, Abraham Kahn, the famous editor of the first socialist Jewish newspaper in the world, will speak on the theme, the development of the Jewish labor movement in America, at 8:30 p.m., 50 cents, Maison Commune, 49 Rue de Bretagne. In 1946, the brief obituary notice for Mrs. Anna Kahn, his wife of 80 years, which appeared in the New York Times, did not fail to mention that she had been in the audience when Kahn delivered his maiden speech in Yiddish in 1882. Kahn's career as a pioneer labor leader is well known, but perhaps a number of its features bear repeating and need to be spelled out, because the pioneer years always have an importance totally out of proportion to their seeming or significance totally out of proportion to their seeming importance. In 1884, he helped organize the first Jewish Tailors Union, followed in 1885 by the first Jewish Cloakmakers Union. In 1886, he became co-founder and co-editor of the first Yiddish socialist publication in the United States, the short-lived Dinaya Zeit, and Yiddish was added to his repertoire of written languages, in addition to English and Russian. In 1890, when Morris Hillquit and Louis Miller founded the first stable Yiddish Socialist Weekly, they called upon their friend Kahn to join the staff, well knowing that they would not be able to write or edit the Arbeiter Zeitung without a collaborator who knew both spoken Yiddish and Jewish folkways intimately. Kahn quickly justified their confidence in him, and this is a familiar story, but I think I ought to state it, demonstrating that he alone was a true journalist, able to gauge the pulse of the people. Kahn recognized that if the paper was to succeed, it would have to be a popular newspaper that would satisfy the Jewish immigrants' hunger for knowledge, but realized that the bitter pill had to be sugar-coated. When Kahn smuggled his version of Henry Stanley's article in Scribner's Magazine describing a gory execution in wildest Africa into the paper, his colleagues were horrified, but appreciated its effects on circulation. Although they remained unconverted, Kahn was not to be stopped. He was soon writing a variety of articles under a variety of pseudonyms in grassroots Yiddish,
And many people who I've spoken to tell me that the quality of this Yiddish was remarkable for its closeness to the spoken word, which was at the opposite pole from the rather brittle, highly Germanic syntax that was followed by those who had no Yiddish background. Under a variety of pseudonyms and grassroots Yiddish, appealing to the pre-modern reservoirs of faith and religion of his readers. Under the pseudonym The Proletarian Preacher, he wrote a column entitled The Sedra. This was the Arbiter Siding at this time was a weekly that appeared on Friday. A Marxist exegesis on the weekly portion of the Pentateuch. As Sosius, he popularized applied and theoretical science. As David Bernstein, he recast and improved upon such classics as Don Quixote and Anna Karenina, and introduced his readers to Zola's Germinal and Howells' Traveler from Altruia. As the Hester Street Reporter, he wrote of the popular dancing schools and other curiosities of the Lower East Side. Only when he wrote on socialism did he reveal his identity. Whether as editor or contributor, Kahn consistently supplied from 3 to 5 articles weekly for the Arbiter Siding, which means that he practically wrote the paper, in addition to occasional political doggerel that all bore his personal stamp. His editorship of the Forward was but an extension and elaboration of this experience. Dr. Sergei Ingerman, who came to the United States in 1891 and who was so different from Kahn in so many ways, appreciated Kahn's role, and which he summed up incisively in his Russian memoir, which his daughter, Dr. Eugenia Ingerman, courteously translated for me. Said Dr. Sergei Ingerman, he impressed me as a strongly emotional and temperamental man. But in spite of this, he approached the problems of socialism from a realistic and practical point of view. Theories did not interest him much. Marxism, with which he was somewhat familiar, he was more than somewhat familiar, but this is Dr. Sergei Ingerman who is writing, and Sergei Ingerman was a Marxist, sort of creme de la creme of Marxist in this country. He looked upon as narrow dogmatism, within whose framework it would not be possible to mobilize a big and lively labor movement. He not only wrote well and popularly in Yiddish, but was a favorite orator to boot. He had grown up and been educated in a purely Jewish milieu, which he knew and understood thoroughly. He was familiar with its psychology and therefore could talk to the Jewish masses as no one else could. But his speeches made a peculiar impression on me. They had no plan or system, nor any logical connection of ideas. They were obviously impromptu and improvised. Yet they were packed with original ideas, flashes of oratory, and healthy, earthy Jewish humor and wit, and they charmed his listeners. Hillquit, Morris Hillquit, that is, gave workmen more food for thought. Kahn did more to light in their hearts the sacred fire of protest and battle against the injustices of capitalist society. Kahn, more than any other, influenced the soul of the masses. Kahn's dispatch to the Arbiter Zeitung in 1891, describing the International Socialist Congress at Brussels, where he represented the United Hebrew Trades, sparkles with characteristic Kahn in this characteristic Kahn enthusiasm that Ingerman admired, and has the more or less apocalyptic ecumenical flourish that was to be the keynote and signature that united editor and audience. The International, and this is my translation, which may not be entirely adequate, the International thrives and blooms. The red banners of socialism wave over the united workers of the whole world. No lips can express it, no pen can portray the magic of the occasion. The air is permeated with pure enthusiasm, with a feeling of brotherhood, with a courage and thirst of the fight for freedom. The hum and babble of many tongues spoken in the civilized world alone blend into a spirited crescendo which inflames the heart with revolutionary fire driving every nerve to the sacred struggle and reverberating like a voice informing of speedy victory and the coming earthly paradise of free workmen. At the same Brussels conference in 1891, in the year of the Moscow expulsions, Kahn, the pragmatic Jew, as well as the world citizen, boldly introduced the Jewish question onto the agenda. And this second conference of the International was not transcribed word for word, but was paraphrased by someone who took notes, and it went as follows. It was transcribed in French. First of all, he, Kahn, must make it clear that he did not come to expose the grievances of the Jewish race. He presents himself solely as a workman representing Jewish workmen. He knows that the delegates acknowledge no military question because socialists do not recognize soldiers. Yet circumstances force them to discuss the military question, and the same goes for the Jewish question. Equality is demanded for all. The Jewish question has led to civil war in many countries. Socialists must take a stand in this war, kindled between Christians and Jews. We must express our sympathy for Jewish workmen who are constantly struggling against the sweating system. It is necessary to abolish the class war against them. There are unions in America that refuse to admit Negroes into their ranks. If there were such unions in Russia, they would refuse to admit Jews. All the Russian newspapers attack the Jews, saying that socialist workmen detest Jews. I demand that you declare that this is not true, that you are opposed to all exploiters, whether Jew or Christian, and that you have as much sympathy for Jewish workmen as you do for Christian workmen. The only reason I illustrate this, and this is intended as an illustration, is because it reveals the two-sidedness of Kahn. He had more than two sides, but at least in this particular situation in 1891, he reported the Brussels conference from a more or less ecumenical, apocalyptic point of view to the readers of the Arbeiter Zeitung. In his own presence at the conference, he spoke from a somewhat different angle. One might say that Kahn never ceased to reveal Jewish humanity to the world and the humanity of the world to the Jews. And this, in a sense, was the kind of role that he carved out for himself that is witnessed in this particular conference situation. Kahn's enthusiasm for international socialism, Russian literature, folk Jewishness, in no way clashed with his enthusiasm for his adopted country. Contradictions were inherent in life, and Kahn was not a man who followed logic, and were to be dovetailed rather than resolved. Russian, Yiddish, and English were each a response to different levels of his personality in a complex world. Within a few days of his landing in New York, he began to study English with the intensity of one inspired, the way he did everything. Within weeks, he was giving English lessons to fellow immigrants, and within a few months, the private tutor had become an evening school instructor. Priding himself on his fluency of speech and precise intonation in English public addresses, he never suffered from undue modesty or bashfulness. The written American word, no less than the spoken word, mesmerized Kahn, no less than did the Russian and the Yiddish. And he did not hesitate to be the first to submit his reports of East Side life to the New York World, the Sun, and the Press, and to get them published. And his subsequent career as a writer for the Evening Post and as a police reporter for the Commercial Advertiser give evidence of a very high level of accomplishment. The irrelevance, of course, of American politics to the social issues of the time puzzled Kahn, and the indifference of the electorate exasperated him. But the election stir and spectacle enthralled him. he reported in his memoirs, I already understood that the whole matter for many Americans was little more than a kind of sport. And this made politics even more despicable in my eyes. But the whole political affair was so curious and so full of color. I was feverish with interest. This was in the mudslinging Blaine Cleveland fracas of 1884, the first presidential campaign that the young immigrant was to witness and which cast its spell upon him. I would not only read the Herald but the Sun, he wrote, and sometimes the Tribune and the World as well. I would come home with a pack of newspapers and read and read, but reading alone did not satisfy me. I went to the meetings of the two parties, and I witnessed their demonstrations and other campaign scenes. I could hardly finish my duties at school before I would be off to some political meeting or parade. I will cut to some extent, but I think it is quite evident that when he was to write a good number of years later, that he was unable to restrain himself in plunging into the very circus and spectacle of American life, that it was more than a circus and a spectacle, that as he said in The Rise of David Levinsky, the day of an immigrant's arrival in his new home is like a birthday to him. Indeed, it is more apt to claim his attention and to warm his heart than his real birthday. And certainly this was true in the case of Kahn. When he wrote, as he did on so many occasions in the English periodicals, he presented the Jews of the East Side with a degree of sophistication and realism and literary integrity that was rare for its time, when a time when the stereotype dominated stereotypes of race and religion and nationality and the class dominated the writing of the period. In an era when strikers were stereotyped as godless incendiaries, Kahn described the very God-intoxicated vestmakers of the Lower East Side. And I will not read this passage, which is perhaps not a famous one, but ought to be in the Atlantic Monthly, in which he characterized the striking vestmakers of the Lower East Side in 1898, engaged in completing the reading of the scrolls. The establishment of the great Jewish labor unions in 1910 on a permanent foundation coincided with Kahn's 50th birthday. And this, of course, was a turning point in his career. And of course, he made the best of it. One might say he was a great newspaper man, but he also found himself a very newsworthy subject. This was in a grand tradition of a popular journalism, which he was not the first to discover. In any case, this period opened an era of statesmanship as opposed to agitation. Thereafter, Kahn served the Jewish labor movement as honorary chairman, as a consultant, and was especially close to the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union in New York. When he was invited to speak almost annually, he always reminded his audience that he was there because he was one of them, and not only was he one of them, but he was there before they were, and that everything that he had accomplished, essentially, he had accomplished a long time ago. This, of course, is always the pose of the statesman, the man who has known it all and seen it all. And he told them that he had made all the mistakes as a youth that they were making as youths, and therefore they ought to listen to him. Since he was such a grand success, it was possible even for Jews to listen to a man who was successful, though it was difficult in these years. One of great Kahn's great crimes, unlike most of other Jewish leaders, is that he is not a tragic figure. He may be a tragic figure in some ways, but in the grand sense, he was not a tragic figure, as was virtually every top rank a Jewish leader of the period of his life. He was a grand success. I will not, as I say, read it fully, but I would like to get on to the next stage of Kahn's career, which might be said to begin with his 70th birthday, another occasion and turning point on which his life could coincided so neatly and so nicely with historic events. Kahn's 70th birthday proved an especially auspicious occasion. If at his 50th birthday celebration he could be hailed as the statesman of Yiddish New York, by his 70th, he had become not only the grand old man of the Jewish labor movement, but oddly enough, and perhaps ironically enough, of international socialism as well. 1930 was the last year in which veteran socialists could still view the world with a measure of optimism. The Weimar Republic still seemed viable. Ramsay MacDonald was again Prime Minister of England. Very different sort of Prime Minister than he was in 1922 or 4, but still Prime Minister of England. And Kahn had sparked the successful defeat of the communists in the needle trades unions. In addition to the many notables in literature and journalism, such as Henry Mencken, Theodore Dreiser, Walter Lippmann, Sinclair, Upton Sinclair, Simeon Strunsky, Heywood Broun, and Adolf Ox, who paid their respects to a member of the Fourth Estate, the whole world of international labor and international socialism paid tribute to the living symbol of their history. Leon Blum, Turati, Renaudel, Longer, Modigliani, Frederick Adler, Kautsky, Bernstein, Kerensky, Ehrlich, Alter, Wohl, William Green, Philip Snowden, and a host of others telegraphed their felicitations. Anatole Brailovsky, secretary of the Relief Society for Socialist Prisoners in Russia, reminded, if the audience of the Jewish Daily Forward needed reminding, and I suppose they did, of the failure of the Russian experiment, hailed Kahn as a comrade who always responded to the call of fighters for Russian freedom, suffering most cruel imprisonment and exile under the Soviet regime. Max Sirotsky summed up Kahn's significance for Jewish labor, the Jewish labor movement in America. The Jewish masses and the Jewish workers in particular are proud of Abraham Kahn, the pioneer, the teacher, the man who gave them the light to enable them to find their way. May you live on to see the achievement of the aims of the working masses, which has been your life work. And finally, the labor Zionist Shlomo Kaplonsky best summarized Kahn's meaning for Jewish labor throughout the world. On behalf of the Jewish socialist movement, Pole Zion, throughout the world, I gladly join host of well-wishers. This is a telegram. It is a yuntif for Jewish labor movement, which, irrespective of party, greets you as a veteran champion of socialism, as leader of mighty Jewish labor of America, as creator of greatest Jewish labor daily, and warm-hearted friend of new Jewish commonwealth of labor in Eretz Israel. It is a particular privilege for me at present, sole representative of Jewish socialism in Palestine and executive of Socialist International, to pay tribute to the first envoy of Jewish labor at earliest international congresses. From his first speech in Yiddish to Jewish workmen less than 2 months after reaching America to his final days and nearly 70 years later, Abraham Kahn, despite some serious blind spots, was to entertain progressively fewer doubts about his key judgments on issues central to the lives of his American Jewish readers. If he did not have perfect Jewish pitch, if this musical figure of speech is permissible, he came closer to it than did any of his contemporaries, for his passion for life and his affinity for his times was without parallel. Kahn's career was a great crossroads and a perpetual town meeting of men and of civilizations in articulate turmoil and personal and social reconstruction. He was endowed with gifts of heart and mind responsive to the folk instinct, idiom, and spirit of America, of Jewry, and of Russia, and was fortunate to live at the center of a great folk upheaval, that was to serve as his sounding board. A highly individualistic, personal journalist, he served an association of socialists who presumably could veto his every judgment. Kahn, of course, will always elude the classification. It can be said of Kahn that he was the most Russian of Americans and that he was the most American of Russians. It can be said of Kahn that he was the most Russian of Jews and the most Jewish of Russians. And it can be said of Kahn that he was the most American of Jews and the most Jewish of Americans. Living intensely in the interstices of three great revolutionary civilizations, he was able to assimilate all of them without becoming disoriented. The range of humanity in all its incongruities never ceased to fascinate him. For the novel career of the journalist, generated spontaneously by American conditions, had found in Kahn a man of many exposures and a plurality of identities. Kahn, who along with Simon Dubnow and Theodore Herzl, the three legendary folk figures born to modern Jewry in the year 1860, were each symbols of the world that gave them shape. For America to know Kahn is to, for Americans to know Kahn is to better understand themselves, for through his life flowed the life of a people to whose sentiments he responded and whose pulse he caught with the ingenuity, imagination, and speed of the great newspaper man that he was. A touch of Horace Greeley, a touch of Joseph Pulitzer, a touch of William Randolph Hearst, but mostly Abraham Kahn, a folk product of an unusually important era in modern history. Even his detractors have conceded that Kahn was the most talented, and I'm quoting, and most gifted journalist that the Jews of America ever produced. It is important that we know why. Thank you.